Morning, everybody. Good to see you all. Thanks for coming. I am the placeholder between guests for this series. We were privileged to have David Esterline, the new president of Pittsburgh Seminary, the first week, then Peter Smith, who's the religion writer for the Post-Gazette. Last week, I'm here, holding this week, and then next week, Tony Norman, also a columnist for the Post-Gazette. So I have not prepared much of anything at all, and that's a good thing. Usually when I'm unprepared, that's bad. But today I didn't prepare a talk because I thought, we'll all just talk. I want to have a conversation. So I will have a few opening remarks just to tee up conversation, and then I hope we'll all talk about this most important and fascinating topic, which is the relationship between religion in general, but certainly our Christian faith in particular, and public life. What's permitted, what's not permitted, and how should the one inform the other? So that's our plan, and that's a big topic, and for that reason and many others, let's begin with prayer. Gracious God, we thank you for time together. We thank you for this church. We thank you for all the ways in which your Spirit moves in and through us. And we ask that you be present with us in this room, in these hearts and these minds, opening us to listen for a word from you as we hear it from your Spirit and from one another, to the end that we may be your faithful people, members of the body of Christ, and also citizens of this country that we love. So we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. So I'm really not going to do a talk, but my opening remarks come from this little text. You will recognize this. This is the Constitution of the United States. It's worth looking at. There are only two short passages that I want to refer to. Some of you know that when I was in Carlisle for 9 years, I taught at Dickinson College. And one of the courses I taught was Religion in American Politics and Law. Taught that a couple of times in the 9 years I was there. So there was a time when I really knew all this stuff by heart. I haven't looked at some of the details for a while, but the main themes are still clear. So the first place to start in this little book is with the First Amendment, which, as you know, says several things. But among others, it says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's a phrase worth remembering. You can look it up. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That has become, in American case law, known as the two clauses, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. And one of the great tensions in American life is that the two clauses sometimes conflict with one another. Congress, not the states, but Congress may not establish a religion or do anything that looks like the establishment of religion, but neither can Congress prohibit the free exercise of religion. So one of the big questions has been, when one person's establishment interferes with somebody else's free exercise, what do you do about that? So that's the most familiar text from the Constitution, the First Amendment, that has become the occasion for a lot of case law in America. There's a lesser known line, which I'll just read to you, from Article 6 of the original Constitution, before the amendments, the Bill of Rights. And the last phrase in Article 6 says, the first part says, senators and representatives shall pledge allegiance to the Constitution, offer promise to be guided by the Constitution. But the last phrase says, but no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. Read it again. No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. It is, in other words, unconstitutional to say you cannot be a congressman or a state legislator or representative or president because you are a fill-in-the-blank. Baptist, Presbyterian, Muslim, Jew, Hindu, Buddhist, it's against the Constitution of the United States to prohibit anyone from serving in public office on account of their religion. So those are the only two texts that I want to lift up as the ground of the conversation. That then raises the question of the relationship of church and state. The phrase church and state And separation of church and state does not appear in the Constitution. You know that, right? Nowhere in the Constitution does the phrase separation of church and state appear. Where does that phrase come from? You get extra credit if you know where that phrase came from. Yes, Jefferson, in his letter to the Danbury Baptist Church in Danbury, Connecticut, in his first couple of months, actually, in the presidency. Back in Jefferson's day, the big religious controversies were between people like Baptists and Presbyterians and Episcopalians. And in Virginia, James Madison rounded up Presbyterians and Baptists to oppose the establishment of religion, which was run by whom in Virginia? The Episcopalians. So the original fights over the establishment of religion were that everybody in, well, one of the original fights was that everybody in Virginia had to pay a tax to support the Church of England, which then became the Episcopal Church after the Revolution. And the Baptists said, well, wait a minute, why should we pay for a church that we don't support? And the Presbyterians said, well, yeah, that's right, why should we do that? And so Baptists were accustomed to challenging establishments. And again, for extra credit, what was the established church in New England in that time? Congregational church, very good. And by the way, historical trivia, I was just telling somebody this the other day. Do you know why Congregationalists are thick in New England and Presbyterians are very hard to find? And conversely, Presbyterians are more populous out in the West here, like in Pittsburgh? Anybody know? That's right, that's great. That's exactly right. Jim is right. In 1810... the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians pulled out a map, and they drew a line down the Hudson River. And the Congregationalists, who controlled stuff, said, we'll take all the good stuff east of the Hudson River, and you can have all those woods west of the Hudson River. What they didn't know was that there was 2,500 miles of woods west of the Hudson River. So that is why, to this day, if you go to New England and you look for a Presbyterian church, it will be hard to find, but New England is thick with congregationalists, including, by the way, my wife, who is a Yankee Congregationalist to the core. The theologies are pretty similar, but it all had to do with what Jim's describing in 1810, divvying up the territory. So, church and state, separation of church and state does not appear in the Constitution. That's sort of a shorthand form for how people talk about this. What the phrase points to, and what Jefferson was saying, is really what's contained principally in the First Amendment, but also in the sixth article of the original Constitution, and that is that the institution of the state cannot significantly infringe upon the institution of the church and vice versa. State cannot set up a church. It cannot destroy churches. It cannot interfere with the internal workings of the church in most cases, with very few exceptions. And conversely, the church cannot create an official establishment of religion. That's what it means institutionally. That's a different thing from saying religion should have nothing to do with politics. So let me explain that, then I'm going to stop and we'll talk. When people say, well, religion should keep out of politics, that depends on what you mean. If you mean that churches ought not to make partisan commitments, that's absolutely right. In the Johnson era, Congress passed a law prohibiting that, authorizing the IRS to remove people's 501c3 not-for-profit status if churches who have 501c3 status, for example, become centers of campaigning for any particular party or candidate. That's prohibited by law in America. So in that sense, churches may not engage in partisan politics. That's a completely different thing from saying religion has to stay out of public life or stay out of politics, small p, if by politics you mean what Aristotle meant, namely living together in the polis. That's where the word comes from. When Aristotle wrote about ethics in public life 400 or 500 years BC, he said, human beings are social animals. We live together in the polis, by which he meant Athens, but by extension, any community. And so politics was simply how it is that we live together in a community. In that sense, religion has never been in America, and I want to argue can never be, completely separate from politics. Because if your religion didn't inform the way you live in community, what sort of religion would that be? It might be some sort of private me and God thing that has to do entirely with another world. It would not be the religion of the Bible. If you read the Bible seriously, you know that the prophets of the Old Testament, for example, which, by the way, were speaking to a religious society, which was the Jewish people, the state of Israel at the time, prophets are all about how to live together in public life. Jesus has a lot to say, as do other portions of the New Testament, about how Christians ought to live in their public life. So, here's the key distinction. In America, church and state are separated in the sense that the institutions of the state and the institutions of the church are not to interfere formally with one another. That's very clear. And churches must not, in this country, take the side of a particular candidate or a particular party, or else they lose their 501c3 status. But religion in America has always spoken to public life. And I would argue that it can't but do otherwise. So, in the 19th century, virtually every movement of social reform in America was driven largely by religious folk, and particularly by Protestant Christians. So, schools, when they decided to set up education, public schools, it was church folk who often created those schools. There's no coincidence that we have all kinds of colleges in this country started by Methodists and Presbyterians and Congregationalists. Harvard, of all places, and Yale started out to be schools to train the Christian ministry. Prisons, reforming prisons for more humane treatment of prisoners, that movement was driven by Christians. Slavery, of course, was defended by slaveholders, but the abolition movement was driven largely by Christians who said, this isn't right. God says, treat your neighbor as you would want to be treated. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Clearly, slavery is incompatible with that. So the abolition movement, later on the civil rights movement, various kinds of protests against war. Almost every social movement in America in the 19th and early 20th century was driven to a large extent by Christian people. Religion has always in America informed our political life. That's a different thing from the institution of church and the institution of state meddling formally in each other's affairs. Let me stop there and see what you want to talk about. And truly, that's all I got. So, I mean, there's a lot up here, but I don't want to dominate the conversation. I want to know what you've been thinking, perhaps from David Esterline or Peter Smith, or just because it's in the air. What are the concerns that you have, perspectives that you want to share? Yeah, please.
I'm just curious. Maybe because of the Johnson era that puts certain restrictions, perhaps, on you. How do you deal with that, and how conscious are you of that? Those implications.
How do I personally deal with those constraints? Very carefully. Trust me, very carefully. Churches are, among other things, voluntary organizations, and especially Protestant churches are voluntary organizations. One of the striking things about America is we haven't had, since roughly the time of the early Republic, that's to say the first couple of decades after the Revolution, we haven't had an officially established religion. Now, when the First Amendment says Congress shall not make an establishment of religion, part of the reason was the states already did. New England had establishments that were Congregationalist, the South had establishments that were mostly Episcopalian, and the Mid-Atlantic states, like Pennsylvania and Jersey, tended not to have establishments. But since, about, I think, the last disestablishment, by the way, longest word in the English language, right? Anti-disestablishmentarianism, that's being against disestablishing the official religions. So if you're an anti-disestablishmentarian, that means you wanted to keep the Congregationalists in charge of Connecticut and Massachusetts. That's what that means. Not an issue anymore, so you don't have to know that word. So, one of the sort of paradoxes of religion in America is that America has not had an established religion for a long, long time, unlike, say, even England, where the Church of England is the official religion. And places like Italy and Ireland and so forth are either officially or semi-officially Roman Catholic. And yet, people have always pointed out how religious the American people are. And sociologists have said, well, that's because religion in America has a robust market. And it's the nature of markets that providers and consumers sort of line themselves up. So religion in America is sort of this vast marketplace where churches, particularly Protestant churches, have to appeal to their congregations as voluntary participants, because that if you just... Do I need this?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. I trust you. All right. Oh, it's the recording, all right. So anyway, we are acutely aware of the fact that y'all can walk for any reason whatsoever. And if we think there's something to be said from the gospel to speak to public life, we have to try to do that in such a way that we don't unnecessarily offend people's predispositions along, for example, partisan lines. Long answer, but that's the truth. Everything I tell you is the truth, by the way. At least the truth as I understand it. I usually give you a little warning. The following may be made up. So if ever I know I'm making stuff up, I try to tell you. Mostly I just try to tell you the truth. Other comments, observations? Ted, yeah.
So what do you make of it seems like things are three big events in American history that had religious overtones. One would be the Civil War, as you mentioned. Another might be Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
Another might be Civil Rights Movement.
Yep.
And in each of those, you have a whole lot of polarization of the politics of the age. Do you see any connection?
Yeah. All right. Yes, for sure. And I'm going to try very, very hard to be factual. Okay? Facts are facts. As Senator Moynihan famously said, quoting somebody else, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. They're not entitled to their own facts. As a fact, in the Civil War, there were fervent Christians who were pro-slavery and fervent Christians who were anti-slavery. In the segregation and civil rights era, there were fervent Christians who were pro-segregation and against it. Prohibition was largely a Protestant thing, and it didn't last all that long. But in each of those cases, religious folk were divided against each other. Why is that? I actually have a whole book. I have several books that are very good, and they're very good because they're entirely hypothetical. I haven't written them yet. So they can't be bad because they're not even on paper yet. But one of them is called Religion, Reaction, and Reform. And I actually taught a course called that at Dickinson College some years ago. And the question was exactly the one you're raising, Ted. How is it that not only religious people, but people of the same denomination, Methodists, Baptists, and Presbyterians, those specific denominations split, for example, over the question of slavery in the 1850s? So how is that possible? You read the same Bible. Not only is it the same Bible, you're the same denomination. How does that happen? I think a short description is that people, of course, have other interests besides religion. People have political interests, economic interests, social interests, psychological interests. Some of you know that I often draw a demand curve. No, I can draw a demand curve. I've done this before, but I'll do it anyway. I think morality, like most commodities, has a downward-sloping demand curve. If you've taken even 15 minutes of economics, you know that supply and demand are the basic concepts of neo-capitalist economics. And the concept is that when something costs a lot, other things being equal, economists like to say ceteris paribus, other things being equal, when something costs a lot, people want less of it. When it costs less, they want more of it. That's not always true. But for most commodities, that's the case. So if apples cost, $4 a pound, you don't buy many apples. When they drop to 20 cents a pound, you buy more apples. Really simple idea. So demand has a downward sloping curve because when stuff costs a lot, the quantity purchased is low. When the price goes down, the quantity purchased or desired goes up. My argument is that morality, like most commodities, has a downward-sloping demand curve. That doing what Jesus wants you to do is easier when it doesn't cost you very much. So, we have Food Sunday. Come bring a can of tuna for Shim. And lots of people show up with their cans of tuna. Mother Teresa gives up all her stuff and helps people die with dignity in Kolkata. Okay? Bring in a couple cans of tuna for Shim. Pretty low cost. helping people die well in Kolkata in desperate poverty, pretty high cost. Not surprisingly, lots of people bring in tuna. There are not a lot of Mother Teresa's, which is why she wins the Nobel Prize and is now St. Teresa, right? Same thing. If I'm a slaveholder, then the price of eliminating slavery is extremely high for me because my whole economy depends on that. So, of course, I'm against that. If I'm in the North and don't care about slavery, and by the way, people in the North did care about slavery because, for example, the slave trade and shipping and so forth out of places like Boston was an important source of income, too. But if that's not an issue for me, if it doesn't cost me anything to be against slavery, it's easy for me to be an abolitionist. I think this explains a boatload of human behavior about why people from the same religious background come down very differently on social and political issues. It depends on whose ox is being gored, what costs whom, how much. When it's relatively inexpensive to take a strong stand, like I'm firmly against slavery today, right? My guess is most of you are strongly against slavery. And that costs us pretty much zero because slavery is not a real issue. But it wouldn't be too hard for you to think of some other issues that might be more costly. And then you say, not so sure what I think of that. So long answer to your question. I've got a whole book on this, which I want to write someday. Religion, reaction, and reform. Why is it that people from the same religious tradition sometimes cling to sort of established ways of being, sometimes want to change those? I think it has to do with the fact that people have lots of other interests besides religion. And what they then do is they shrink wrap their religious commitments to take the shape of their other commitments. I just think that's the truth. If you want to disagree with that, let me know. But now, an interesting thing is when that's not the case. Another metaphor is from physics. I'm terminally metaphorical. If you've taken a few minutes of physics, you might have run into vectors. So imagine that an airplane is flying. I've drawn this backwards. Let's do it this way. This is easier. Imagine that an airplane is flying from east to west, and that's its goal, but the wind is blowing in this direction, right? So which way is the airplane actually going to fly? Well, the airplane is actually going to fly through a kind of vector addition in this direction. The combination of its own thrust and the wind is going to cause it to fly in a direction slightly different from where the airplane is pointing. By analogy, I think that religion is one factor among others, and other vectors include economic interests, political interests, social interests, etc. For some people, the religion vector is very big. For Martin Luther King, for Mother Teresa, for anybody who's sort of a religious hero one way or the other, that religion vector is very strong, and economic or social or political or family pressures are relatively weak. For most people, I think it's the case that the economic vectors and the social vectors are fairly strong. So even if you think your religion is saying do unto others as you want them to do unto you, if your social or economic or political vector is pointing in a different direction, you're going to fly in some place that is the sum of those vectors, not entirely what the gospel might have you do. I just think that makes sense. I've been watching people for 45 years. I'm pretty sure this is true. But if you don't think that's true, tell me, because I don't want to mess that up when I write the book. Please, Bobby.
Going opposite directions.
Absolutely. Yeah. Bobby's saying, are there times when people's religious vectors go in opposite directions within the same denomination? Absolutely. Do you have an example in mind?
Perhaps the issue of homosexuality.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, as you know, if you've been here at all in the last couple of years, you know that Westminster had a year-long conversation about the same-sex marriage question. Because the denomination said that churches could be open to this and the whole country was going through it, and the Supreme Court even decided, of course, a year ago in June, that same-sex marriage should be legal. So that's a very good example. I think what happened there is that people read the Bible and people had other kinds of considerations, and I think that was a great example of how people of genuine good faith could simply disagree depending on how they weighted certain factors. So not to rehash that entire conversation, but if you were here, we had it, and I think we did it pretty well. There are about 10 passages in the whole Bible that could be interpreted as relating to homosexuality. Well, that depends on how you define what those passages are about. But to the extent that the Bible says anything about same-sex physical relations, and those are well-chosen words, it has nothing positive to say. That's very clear. So if all you do is read this group of 8 or 10 texts and interpret what they're talking about as being what we would now call homosexual orientation and all that goes with that, then it seems pretty clear to you that, yeah, homosexuality is against the will of God, and therefore if you're a Bible-believing Christian, you should be against it. And not surprisingly, lots of churches have taught that, and lots of people believe that. And some churches have left the PCUSA because they just thought that was a deal breaker. I respect that. I personally disagree with that because I think what those texts say is less clearly relevant to the contemporary question than some people think. But I have complete respect for people who came to that conclusion because their way of reading the Bible and the fact that they didn't have other experiences that helped qualify that understanding of the Bible caused them in good faith to see things that way. That's a case where I think we just agree to disagree. We have people within Westminster, by the way, who have all different views on that. Westminster does not have a homogeneous view on that. But we're a place where we say people can have different views on that kind of subject. That's not one of the fundamentals. That's not a sine qua non of being a Christian, that people of good faith can simply see that differently. Some churches say, no, if you're really a Christian, you can't see that differently. There's nothing to argue about. I think we just agree to disagree. Yeah, please.
Question on, have you discussed exactly where the church stands on the issue of immigration?
On the issue of what?
Immigration.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Sometimes people ask the question and you say, you know, love to talk about that, but we're out of time. But we still have half an hour, so thanks, Dan. Yes. The PCUSA, like most mainline Protestant churches and the Roman Catholic Church, believe that the thrust of the Bible is about welcoming the stranger, and that God loves all people, and that we ought to treat others as we would want to be treated. And therefore, there's a sort of predisposition, at a minimum, not to hate or despise the foreigner. So that's self-evident. I don't see how anybody can argue that. Second, America, of course, is almost entirely made up of immigrants, right? I mean, a handful of people were Native Americans, but that just means they came 10,000 years ago from Asia, not, you know, a couple hundred years ago or 50 years ago. So almost everybody in this country is a descendant of immigrants. And so church folk have said, look, that's our whole heritage. There's a predisposition to treat people well as we would want to be treated, and therefore a sort of predisposition to be welcoming to immigrants. That said, however, the rule of law is important. And you can believe that the gospel would have you be welcoming to immigrants, particularly refugees, but still people should follow the law. And then, of course, the devil and God are in the details, as they always are. So how do you weigh those two things? If somebody's here without having done the legal steps, should we kick them out? Well, if what matters most to you is these are the laws and you should follow those laws, then yeah, sure, there's not much question about that. If, on the other hand, you say, yeah, but America has birthright citizenship. That's another thing in this book, by the way. If you're born in this country, you're an American citizen. So what happens if your mom and dad came, you know, 20 years ago and have been picking grapes or something for 20 years, and you were born 18 years ago in America? You are an American citizen. And what if your mom and dad have been working because, by the way, the guy that runs the vineyard or the you know, grape farm likes the fact that he can pay you less because you're undocumented and be easy to kick you out, so you don't fuss about that. What should you do? Should you kick those people out or not? They're here illegally in the sense that they didn't follow the rules, and some people would say, well, there's nothing to talk about. Kick them out. Other people would say, well, yeah, but first of all, you're doing jobs that other people seem not to want to do, apparently, and your kids are here, and so do we really want to break up families in order to enforce that law? And that, of course, is where people go back and forth. It's important to uphold the laws. Compassion and practicality and birthright citizenship are important, too. And people simply come down in different places on that. So some people, as you know, would say, kick them all out, they broke the law, end of story, nothing else to talk about. Some people would say there should be a sort of general amnesty. A lot of people, and I do think this is sort of the hump of the curve. I think it's the case, tell me if you know better. I think it's the case that when Gallup and Pew and those people do surveys, there's a the modal point would have people want for those who do not break the laws otherwise to have a path to citizenship for many, if not all, of people who got here illegally. I think that's the hump of the curve in terms of the predominant view. But of course, there are people who feel very strongly, and there are a lot of them, that you break the law, you should leave. So the Presbyterian Church, sort of waffles on that, recognizing the importance of both things, and says, whatever we do, we ought to be compassionate, we ought to treat people as we would want to be treated. People should follow the law, of course, so let's figure out a way to be humane and preserve the rule of law. And that, of course, doesn't answer the question. But it does invoke the considerations, right? I don't know if that's helpful, but I think that's the truth. Please, Harry. Yeah.
Do you think we'll see the same effect with both homosexuality and abortion?
So I was asking, it took quite a while for attitudes to change, sort of generational change about slavery. Will we see the same thing on abortion and homosexuality? I think the demographics are very clear with regard to homosexuality. And we pulled out a lot of these surveys a year ago when we were discussing the issue. It's clear as day that each younger generation is more accepting of homosexuality than the previous generation. And I don't have in my head now what those numbers are, and they're changing all the time. But clear as day, if you plot, people over 65 versus people, say, 45 to 65 versus 25 to 45 versus under 25, that graph just looks like this in terms of opposing homosexuality. So, I think the demographics on that are pretty clear. I don't see any reason to believe that's going to change because the law now permits it. And I think what's going to be the case is that 50 years from now, when most of us are gone, people who are now 20 or 30-something are going to be explaining to their kids why that was even an issue. I think that's going to be the case. Now, that doesn't answer the question, is it good or bad? People who think that's good say it's just progress and it takes time and that's wonderful. People who think it's terrible just means it's the decline of our country. So that's not to make a moral judgment, but your question was about where do we think it's going to go. I think the demographics on that are very clear. Abortion is different, though, because abortion has to do with another set of issues. It has to do with what constitutes a person. The official teaching of the Roman Catholic Church is from the moment of conception, this developing thing is a person and is in some sense ensouled. And so it's very hard to see that position changing. Of course, abortion is an intimate choice that's hugely significant in the lives of people, especially women who are pregnant and trying to decide about that. That's not going to go away. That is always going to be, for any woman who is pregnant and thinks maybe this isn't a good thing, that's always going to be an issue for that woman and for the people most closely related to her. There is some indication, by the way, I don't know if you all heard this, but just in the last few weeks there have been some studies showing that teenagers are having less sex than people a generation older, than the boomers did, and that the abortion rate has been going down a bit. Now, it's still quite high. I mean, there's still many hundreds of thousands of abortions in America, but the rate has been going down. And that's for all kinds of reasons. I think the answer to your questionnaire on homosexuality is pretty clear. There will always be some people who think this was a wrong turn and America's, depraved for doing this. The vast majority are going to say, why was that even an issue? Abortion, I think, is different because the nature of that issue is different and it's sort of new for every generation that has to face those decisions. That's just my view. Does anybody see that differently? Others? Comments? Questions? Please, Jim.
You mentioned the test for religion. all number of people who voted against John Kennedy because he was Catholic, against Mitt Romney because he was Mormon,
sure,
against Barack Obama because we don't know if he was Muslim.
Right.
And so,
right.
That is a practical reality because we all fight,
right,
our own religious values. But that can be a good thing. I mean, in terms of evaluating someone's character, if they not only have committed adultery, they're boasted about it, if they not only have practiced racism, but have made statements that are clearly racist, and if they have stolen people's tuition by falsely promising, they are guilty of violating basic principles of not only Christians, but Judeo-Christians, and should be put to the test of their character and what that represents in terms of serving an office.
This is an entirely hypothetical example, of course. but just suppose there was somebody like that. Well, you point to an important thing, Jim, which is, I think what you're saying is the test is not religion per se. The question is not, do you have a membership in, you know, some church or some mosque or synagogue or whatever? That's not the question. The question is, does whatever you claim your religion to be inform your character in such a way that people think that character perhaps reflects the values of their own religion, first of all, and second, reflects the kind of values that you want to be in someone who holds a high office in the United States. That's where it comes in. And you're absolutely right to say, and that's why I said at the outset, church and state are institutionally separated in America, and that's a very good thing, and that's not going to change. But religion and politics, in Aristotle's sense of life in the polis, are not now and never have been separated, and that's largely because of what you're pointing to. Insofar as religion shapes people's beliefs and character, it shapes or should help to shape the way they relate in public life, and therefore, in that kind of secondary sense, a person's true religion ought to play out in the character. And if the character reflects that in a way that religious folks say, yeah, that's consistent with my beliefs, terrific. And if it doesn't, if people say, well, that's not how I understand the will of Jesus, or for that matter, Muhammad or Moses, then people on religious grounds will oppose that person. But not because that person has a formal membership in the Roman Catholic Church or the Mormon Church or whatever, but because they think the character doesn't fit what the religion calls for. That's right, for sure. One of my favorite little quips, some of these apocryphal stories are so good they should be true even if they weren't. It was said that Robert Kennedy asked John F. Kennedy, JFK, whether he was concerned that Martin Luther King might run for president. And JFK supposedly said, I don't know. Do you think the country's ready for a Baptist? It's a great line. And, of course, it wasn't until Jimmy Carter later on that the country said, yeah, okay, we'll take a Baptist, right? That's a good line. I also like the line, some of you heard me say this, that Jackie Kennedy supposedly said, and somebody in this church has told me that they actually saw the recording of this, Jackie Kennedy said, you know, I think it's so unfair that people give Jack such a hard time about being Catholic. He's such a bad Catholic. I thought that was an apocryphal story, but somebody told me they'd actually seen the clip, so maybe that's true. Other comments? Well, come on, we're going to run out of... got more time than we can use here.
Okay.
That's okay. Go for it.
Question that we actually talked about faith and life the other night, and it's still sort of bothering me. If a person... if there are challenges to a person because they are a particular religion, for example, John Kennedy or Mitt Romney, is it fair to judge a person not because, I'm not able to,
You want to think about that one? I would jump over to Janice here,
yeah.
And if that comes clear, let me know. Janice, please. Yeah, that's a great observation, James. Two or three things. First of all, the Faith in Life group on Wednesday nights at 6:30 and 2:31 is reading a book called The End of White Christian America, where the title is a little more provocative than the whole book. But the title kind of gives away the plot in the sense that it's what you just said. insofar as in, say, 1952 or 3, it might still have been the case that most of America was run by essentially WASPs, as they were called at the time, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. That's basically true. And insofar as that was true circa 1952, 3, 4, it's emphatically not true today, and the demographics are such that it's going to be less true in the coming decade. So that's true for sure. I just bought a book a couple weeks ago, which I haven't started yet, about how some of the founders, George Washington in particular, but also Jefferson, who had dealings with Tripoli and the Middle East, how they thought about Muslims. And when the sixth article of the Constitution says there'll be no religious test, some scholars are saying Jefferson and Washington and the gang had Muslims in mind as well. They weren't just talking about Baptists and Presbyterians and Congregationalists. They actually, because they knew Muslims, they'd been diplomats and so forth. And so they had them in mind, even though Muslims were almost non-existent as a part of the population. Jews were a tiny part, Muslims even less. So there's an argument to be made, I'll let you know after I read the book, that Muslims were in mind when they wrote this document. Now, what about bigotry? I'm going to go out a little bit on a limb here, but I think this is true. If it's not true, tell me why it's not true. I go to the dictionary for definitions, and if you haven't been to church yet, you will hear the Merriam-Webster definition of bigotry. And I don't want to quote it here because I want to get it exactly right. I stay close to the text in the sermon. But it basically is any predisposition to hatred or enmity on the basis of an entire group, as, for example, a religious or ethnic or racial group. That's the dictionary definition of bigotry. It just is. That's what the word means. I encounter, and perhaps you've encountered, people who say, well, I'm not prejudiced, but... And then they go on to tell something about, you know, black folk. And they'll say, I'm not sexist, but... And then they go on and say something that's demeaning to women. Because everybody knows it's uncool to be prejudiced and sexist and racist. We all know that. So whatever you're going to say, you have to preface it by saying, I'm not this, but... Nobody wants to cop to being a bigot. Almost nobody, right? So people say, well, I'm not bigoted, but... Well, the dictionary definition is... I mean, if that's not what the word means, then what does the word mean? The dictionary definition of bigotry is, if you have a predisposition to hostility towards people on the basis of some classification, I'm paraphrasing now, race, ethnicity, religion, that's what bigotry means. So let's tell the truth. If you think that Muslims should be banished because they are Muslims, that, by definition of the dictionary, is bigotry. Now, it might be justified. You might say, yeah, well, Muslims are a danger. They're a threat to our country. Okay, fine. But there's no question that to categorically dismiss an entire group of people on the basis of a characteristic like that is bigotry. That's the very definition of bigotry. Now, again, if you think those people are a serious threat to the nation, then, yeah, maybe you ought to get rid of them in the way that in the 1950s, communists, you know, were thought to be that way. The mere fact that one lumps together whole groups of people doesn't mean it's wrong to do that for some other reason, but it is by definition bigotry. That's just true. Look it up in your dictionary. So, what do Christians say about that? Well, we're against it. This is the sermon, you know. Part of the sermon is this. The sermon isn't just about that. But part of the sermon is, it's about what do you do about the enemy. That's the point today. And Jesus says, love your enemies. I don't want to tell you the whole thing because I don't want you to go home. Got to keep you hanging a little bit. You're going to show up over here. But Jesus says, love your enemies. And he's talking about people that actually are your enemies. And he says, don't hate your enemies, even the people that actually are. Well, if it's wrong in the eyes of God to hate people who really are your enemies, how much worse to hate people who just have some superficial resemblance to your enemies? Is it conceivable that Jesus likes that? I think the answer is self-evidently no. How is that possible? Now, as a prudential matter, what do you do about the fact, and it's an indisputable fact, that in some Muslim circles, for example, a certain kind of jihadi theology is proclaimed, and young guys who are full of testosterone and don't have a good career path sometimes get caught up in that and go and do bad things. That's indisputable. That's a simple fact. The number of people who do that is extremely small as a percentage of Muslims in America. But it happens. So if your prudential judgment is, this is the Skittles thing, right? If your prudential judgment is that even a few of those are not worth the risk and you ought to get rid of the whole gang, well, okay, that's a prudential judgment. I think by the dictionary's definition, that is bigotry. And I think the sense of the gospel, as I read Jesus, is Jesus doesn't like that. And so then you're left with the hard thing. What is left with the hard thing? It is how not to be a bigot, how not to judge people on the basis of race or nation or class or religion or whatever, but still, how prudentially to protect yourself and others. God and the devil are in the details, you know? But in America, we've always had the rule of law, haven't we? And we've always said you're innocent until you're proven guilty. You're sure as heck not guilty just because you look a certain way or just because you show up at a certain house of worship. That's never been the American tradition. Right? So we got to do the hard work of figuring out how to sort out this stuff and prevent young Muslim guys from getting charged up with some jihadi nonsense and going out and doing bad things. And by the way, did you read that the guy the other week, his dad turned him in 2 years ago? Did you read that? Well, that's the point. I meet every year, some of you know, I meet every year for 24 hours or so with the Council on Foreign Relations Workshop on Religion and International Affairs. So I sit around with 120 people, Muslims, Jews, Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, people from all over the place, and we talk about this stuff. And I can tell you that the Muslims, and they're sort of my age, you know, they're 50s, 60s, or older, their biggest nightmare is that their boys, because it's mostly their boys, sometimes it's girls, is that their boys will get seduced by this kind of stuff and go off and do bad things that they would say is contrary to the spirit of the Islam that they believe in, number one. Number two, will bring down the wrath of less thoughtful Americans who then trash their their mosques and all that kind of stuff. And by the way, there's no question that in the last year, this has come out in the last couple weeks too, in the last year, the number of anti-Muslim incidents has skyrocketed. It skyrocketed, not surprisingly, after 9/11, 2001. It has jumped again, second only to the rate after 9/11 in the last year. One might think there are good reasons for that. Good reasons in the sense of you could point to why that happens. But there's no question that it's happening. So these Muslim guys that I talk to, that's their worst nightmare. That some guy's going to come and seduce their kids, and their kid's going to go off and do something stupid and kill and hurt people, and that's going to be terrible, and it's going to bring down the wrath of the community on them. And this guy, this kid that did some stuff, you know, a few weeks ago, his dad turned him in 2 years ago. And the FBI interviewed the kid, and they just couldn't find anything to make it stick. He was kind of on their watch list, but it was his dad who turned him in. And that's essential, because the national security people will tell you, and I talk to those too, the national security people will tell you cannot fight something like Islamic terrorism unless you've got sympathetic Muslims helping you out. unless people in the Islamic community come forward and say, you know, young Ahmed worries me here because he's been watching some bad stuff on the internet and he's been doing some questionable stuff. Unless people from the Muslim community who will see these things first come forward and tell the FBI or police or whatever, you know, keep an eye on Ahmed because he worries me. You can't. You can't fight this sort of stuff. And by the way, there are always going to be these lone wolf things. That's just going to happen. Get used to it. I mean, we every time some bad thing happens, you know, something fires in our brains and we get all worked up and we say, oh no, the terrorists are taking over. That's not true. What did I read the other day? The probability of being killed in America by a foreign, by an immigrant, no, sorry, the probability of being killed in America by an immigrant refugee in the last 10 years is 1 in 3.5 billion. Now, I don't know if that number is literally true, but it's very, very small. But every time it happens, every time some jerk shoots up some people, that gets on the news and everybody thinks, oh no, the Muslims are going to kill us. Well, no. There's a country of 315 million people, and people that are not well-grounded are going to do bad stuff. And that's not going to stop. The question is, are we going to become a bigoted people? By the dictionary definition, are we going to become a bigoted people who write off whole populations because from time to time somebody who's arguably a part of that population, though a very small fraction of it, does an awful thing? If that's the case, we're going to be a very different America from the one that I grew up in, and it won't be better. Please.
Okay, I have my thought together now, I
think. Okay, good.
No, I was thinking, I'm thinking of people who, for whom their faith has become somewhat of a public issue. Like, for example, John Kennedy being the first Roman Catholic to win, anyway, and Mitt Romney, and even Jimmy Carter, somewhat. And the sort of general thought that came about at, for all of them was, oh my goodness, this is not a good thing, because what if, in the case of John Kennedy, what if the Vatican is telling him
right.
what to do?
Right, right, right.
In the case of Mitt Romney, what if the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is giving
right.
him orders
right,
and
right.
so forth? So then the question becomes, what happens if the tenets of your faith interfere with what the perhaps our nation is saying or what we consider to be the norm?
Right. So if you follow that, Bobby's asking, so what if the tenets of your faith really do conflict with some public norm in America? Well, that in fact is not a hypothetical question, because the law of free exercise has, well, again, the free exercise and establishment clauses have a whole case history of dealing with exactly that question. So, if the Mormons, by the way, this was the first big issue before Utah was even a state, when Utah was still a territory, the first major issue on the First Amendment occurred around 1870, I think, about the question of polygamy in the Utah territory. And the question was, the Mormons claimed at that time that you should be free to practice polygamy, and that's a part of our religion. And polygamy was against the law in the United States and by extension in the territories governed by the United States. So the question was, should Mormons be allowed to practice polygamy on religious grounds? Which trumps which? Does the free exercise of their religion as they claim trump what is otherwise considered to be the law of the land? In that case, the decision was no. That there's a sufficient public interest, that polygamy is a bad enough thing, that even if you claim that this is part of your religion, you don't get to do that in America. And what happened was, the Mormons then officially gave up polygamy because they wanted statehood. That was the first big case in America. It was a free exercise claim. Indians would smoke peyote, and they would say, you know, well, this is part of our religion, it's a part of our ceremony. Well, it's against the law to do peyote in Oregon, I think, where the case came up. So again, the question was, so should they be allowed to do that, or should they not, because it sort of violates public law. So that's where the conflicts come in. Now, in the case more recently, John Kerry, for example, ran for president a few years ago, and he's Catholic. And he said that if I were president, I would not do anything to restrict abortion. Well, the cardinal, whoever the cardinal was in Boston, threatened to excommunicate him, right? Because he said, that's contrary to Catholic practice, you can't do that. Kerry said, I understand that, Bishop. But if I'm elected president, I pledge to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the land. And if the law of the land says this thing is permissible and my church says no, as a public official, I have to uphold the law of the land. That's my pledge. And so I think most of the responsible, and Romney did the same thing, most of the responsible candidates, if their religion teaches something other than something that's contrary to the law of the land, if you're going to be a public official in America, you support the law of the land. Or you try to change it. And of course, that's what the desegregation movement was. It was against the law in North Carolina for black folk to go to certain kinds of swimming pools or sit at lunch counters and stuff. And they said, well, that is against the law, but the law is wrong. And so they tried to change the law, they did sit-ins, they did all that stuff, and then they changed the law. So, yeah, that's how it's played out in America. We have a couple more minutes, then we got to go. Yes, John.
Our society in the last few decades has been successful in getting religion out of education publicly. I have read, you know, some analysis that say that says that children in public schools, probably for a week too, are not being exposed to especially Western thought, the great literature. Been so successful in getting religion and especially Christian authors out of the education. Where would you come down on this matter? How much we should expose all children to some of the religious literature?
Oh, I think even public schools ought to expose children to all sorts of different religious perspectives. Absolutely. The only thing that the state cannot do, and by the way, the school is an instrument of the state, which is why the court ruled in the early 60s, you can't begin the day with reading from the Bible, and you can't begin the day with teacher-led prayers. Students, if they want to go pray, you know, after school or something, they can do that. They can do that in public schools. But the teacher can't do it because the teacher, in that respect, is an agent of the state. But if you're teaching religion as a social or historical fact of American life, some people believe this, some people believe that, this is how this religion has affected America, absolutely, that's permitted constitutionally, and some schools do that. And I think that's a very good thing. Somebody was saying the other day in our Faith and Life group that, you know, people say when the Supreme Court took the Bible out of the schools, everything went to pot, literally and metaphorically. And, well, some of the teachers that were doing, you know, were teaching in those days said, yeah, but, you know, that was just pro forma. You know, it wasn't like for a lot of students that was a moment of fervent piety. You know, it was just kind of what you did. So I don't make too much of that, but I think religion absolutely should be taught. I was, in between my Methodist and Presbyterian lives, I ran a nonprofit organization for kids, but then for 2 years I was the director of operations for a national standards in education program, where half the states in the country, well, half the kids in the country, 18 states, but half the kids, the states were trying to set up standards for what students should know and be able to do. It was easy when it came to reading, because everybody should be able to read. Math was pretty easy, because 2 + 2 = 4 in Oklahoma and in New York, not much of a problem there. What was controversial was the history standards, for exactly the reason that you're pointing to. And I sat in on the discussions where they were trying to figure out what should the history standards be. And I think the term political correctness is way overused, way, way, way overused. That becomes a way to shoot down anything you don't like. That said, however, I was in the hotbed of political correctness when they were trying to figure out what the history standards should be. Because it was a bunch of boomers who grew up, you know, in the 60s protesting stuff, and they wanted Sacagawea and, you know, all kinds of other perspectives to be seen. And to do that, because there's only so much time in the curriculum, you had to eliminate some stuff. And some of the stuff that would be eliminated was sort of classic, you know, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson stuff, and for sure religion. So I've actually seen the discussions in which people trying to figure out state standards are inclined to eliminate religion maybe because they themselves don't think it matters. I think that's wrong. The Constitution does not require that. And I think, but the problem is you got to have teachers who can do this sensibly and sensitively, right? And that's not easy. You got to have a teacher who may be, you know, fervent Christian or Jew or Muslim or something. You got to have a teacher who can stand up in front of a bunch of, you know, 15-year-olds and say, here's what the world looks like from a Muslim perspective, from a Christian perspective, and a Jewish perspective, and do that with sympathy so that you're not just sort of throwing up straw men to knock down, but also without proselytizing students. That's really hard. By the way, some of you know, I was invited to teach the Introduction to Religion course at Carnegie Mellon starting in January, and I'm really excited about that because it's just a couple hours a week, not to worry. But I'm really excited about that because, of course, the students at Carnegie Mellon are crazy smart, and because it's such a techie place, there'll be kids from India and from China, and you know, there'll be Jewish kids and Muslim kids, and there'll be a bunch of kids whose parents said, religion is for dumb people who don't know science. And what great fun, you know, to spend a semester with 25 of those really smart kids and do kind of what you're talking about, not in public school, but in a university, and say, well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about what the world looks like sympathetically from a Muslim perspective or a Buddhist or a Jewish or a Hindu perspective or a Christian perspective. So I'm going to have some practice in that starting in January, and I'll report back. Yes, Ed, then we got to quit.
Do you think you'll ask the students what their religious affiliation is?
I've thought about that, and I think no. And the reason is that I don't want people to be on the spot and feel like discussions about religion are ad hominem. If you feel like you have to defend your religion, then after a while, it's not about what the world looks like from the perspective of the religion. It's about somebody's attacking me and I've got to defend myself. And then the quality of discussion goes down. So I think I'll let people hold the cards close to their vest. If anybody wants to share, they can. But I want to create an environment where people are free to talk. All right. Well, that wasn't hard to fill up an hour. Thank you all. Next week.